Have you ever felt a twinge of worry about AI taking over your job or diluting your creativity? Well, what if you could turn that fear into creative fuel? We've just published an amazing new ebook called The 4 Keys to Success in an AI World, and this is more than just a guide. It's a deep exploration into the human skills that AI can't touch, the skills that are essential for standing out and thriving no matter how much technology evolves. We're talking about real differentiators here like creativity, emotional intelligence, critical thinking, and much more. Inside, you'll find actionable insights and strategies to develop these skills, whether you're a creative person, a business person, or just simply someone who loves personal development. This isn't a story about tech taking over. It's a story of human creativity thriving alongside AI. Picture this: AI as your creative co-pilot, not just as a tool, but a collaborator that enhances your unique human skills. The 4 Keys ebook will show you exactly how to do that and view AI in a new way that empowers you instead of overshadows you. Transform your creative potential today. Head over to unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. Use the number 4, KEYS. That's unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. And download your free copy.
Comics, whether you want to admit it or not, have been around almost since the beginning of mankind. You know, the Caves of Lascaux are comics. The Sistine Chapel literally has sequential panels showing narrative change over time. They don't have word balloons. But it's literally a fucking comic on the walls, not on the ceiling. The ceiling is just a giant tableau. But like, you look at the walls and it's just, you know, it's biblical stories told through image and sustaining images over time, which is what a comic is. I found them when I was really young, probably 4 or 5. I was really obsessed with the Hardy Boys and Nancy Drew and Boxcar Children, kind of boy and girl adventurer detective style stories. And we were at the library and they had a large collection of Hergé's Tintin comics, the bande dessinée about a, you know, young boy reporter and his talking dog. And I lost my mind. I was just like, oh yeah. Oh no, yeah, this is what it is. This is what I should do.
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com. Dave, welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's my pleasure to have you here. So I found out about your work because you wrote in to tell us a little bit about your new book and, you know, the work you've done in comics and building a career, creative career, all of which we will talk about. But before we get started with that, I want to start by asking you what I think is a very relevant question. And that is, what did your parents do for work and how did that end up shaping the choices that you've made throughout your life and career?
Oh, man. Wow. That's like a big ass question for the 35 words that it took you to say that. Jesus. Yeah, I think the factual answer is that my father is an aerospace engineer and my mother is a drama teacher and theater director. I'm from Tucson, Arizona originally, and my mom had a theater out there and my dad worked for various companies. He built mechanical hearts for a while. He worked on a hydrogen fuel cell for a hydrogen powered car in the early 2000s, and also worked on guidance systems for jets. He worked on the SR-71 Blackbird and the stealth fighter, and I think the Joint Strike Fighter. So yeah, he's you know, like I said, aerospace engineer, and he's a very engineer, like to the T, very kind of, is it right brained with that's all math or creative people are left brained or vice versa?
Yeah, it's left if I remember correctly.
Okay, yeah, I don't remember, but let's just say whichever one of those is the stereotype for an engineer, he's that. And my mom is very creative. She obviously is a theater professor and she's a painter and a quilter. She's really into folk art. And yeah, I think that they both had a tremendous influence on me and what I wanted to do, primarily in that they were both like, you should follow your dreams no matter what they are, even if it's comics and there's no money in it. Like, being unhappy is a death sentence. So you should pursue your dreams. And especially, you know, my mom obviously made a living as a creative person, as a theater director and as a theater teacher. And being able to see that, you know, from her perspective and, you know, realizing that there is a path forward, you know, I think a lot of people might not pursue creative endeavors just because they don't have a role model or they don't, creative careers are really scary because there isn't a rubric. There isn't a path, you know, there isn't a, well, if you apply for the job as famous painter, you will get it. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, she was always very encouraging of that and very, you'll figure it out. Just go make stuff. Yeah.
That's really unusual, I think, for parents to tell you, you know, go follow your dreams, even if there's no money in it. Why do you think that is? Why do you think that your parents, you know, encourage that? Why do you think so many others discourage it? And how do we unwind this sort of cultural narrative of the starving artist?
I think my parents were supportive of it because their parents were not. They were both Air Force brats. They moved around a lot. I think they both had ambitions to do creative work. You know, my mother actually did. And I think, you know, my father was a musician for a long time and got tired of, you know, being dirt poor and kind of chose to go back to school and become an aerospace engineer, which is kudos to him for being able to do that, because I couldn't just wake up one morning and be like, all right, I'm going to go be an aerospace engineer. Like, I'm not good at math enough to do that. But he was. You know, I think they both kind of, they came from really hardcore military families. They were both told they couldn't do things when they attempted. I think that's the scary thing. I think our culture sometimes shies away from the idea of attempt. I think attempting and failing is worse than almost anything in our culture. We want, even if it's a shallow grave of working at 7-Eleven, there's a lot of people that I think get by off of that kind of, there's no risk, you know what I mean? But there's no, there's no potential for embarrassment culturally, you know, there's no weird, awkward growth period where you're trying to figure out how to, you're trying to figure out what your style is. You're trying to make connections in an industry. You're trying to develop and hone a voice. You're trying to prove that you're a person who can turn work in on time. Like, that just doesn't happen when you work at 7-Eleven. Like, you just, you punch the clock and you go home. And I think the weird fallacy within American culture is that as a culture, we want that regularity. We don't want instability for our children and our loved ones. We want the knowledge that they'll be able to provide for themselves every week. Every Thursday, there will be a check and you will have health insurance. And, you know, that's the desire, right? And that's understandable because creative careers are weird and unwieldy. And if you say the wrong thing or do the wrong thing, it potentially could all go away. And that's not me being like, cancel culture is evil. I'm just saying, like, you know, things happen. People commit horrible acts and their careers are taken away justly. And you know, that's not even just in creative careers. That's everywhere these days. Thankfully, you know, I think our culture is reckoning with a desire for accountability that is very positive. Are there slight overcorrections here and there? Maybe, I don't know, but I think that's a weird way to look at those situations where it's like the president or the former president, committed horrible crimes against individuals and against all of us. And I think that that's having a very tangible echo throughout our culture, hopefully in a good way, but we'll see. It's too early to tell.
So your parents encouraged you. What would you say to parents who are listening to this? Because we have a lot of parents who listen to this show about talking to their own kids about pursuing careers in the arts.
I think pursuing a career in the arts is it's something you need to do if it's the thing you need to do, you know? Like, I think there's a section of the population, and this isn't me being hopefully unkind, but there's a section of people who want to be artists or want to be writers, and maybe they don't have the hustle. I think that's really what delineates successful creatives from people who kind of wash out. And saying people wash out, I don't like that phrasing. I don't think life is binary in that way. I don't think that you're a successful person because you tried something and failed, or tried something and got tired of it and decided you wanted something a little bit more regimented. I think life is long, and I think life is complex, and I think sometimes you have priorities that don't match up with your previous self's priorities. That's always hard for people to reckon with, right? It's hard whenever an individual starts to change and evolve or decide they want to do something else. In terms of the parent question, I would just say to ask your kids, like, are you willing to, you know, grind? Are you willing to really fucking hustle? Because that's what it'll take. And if you're really in it to win it and you have to do this, you'll be successful. You know, I don't know what that means for an individual. Like, I don't know if everybody's going to be millionaires, but you'll be able to pay the bills as long as you are somebody who's always attacking it with ferocity. But not everybody has that ability, and not everybody has that privilege. You know, they have responsibilities, they have other needs in their social orbit. And I think that's a conversation to have, you know, like, you know.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
As creators, we're always on the move. Whether it's a live podcast event, a pop-up shop, or a workshop, we're constantly interacting with community, and that's where Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe comes in. Imagine this. You're at a live event, a listener loves your merch, or a participant wants to sign up for your course on the spot. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, you can accept their payments right there and then, right from your iPhone, so there's no extra hardware or no delays. Total game changer. It's not just for creators. Any business owner can do this. It's about making transactions smoother and much more personal, growing your business in your way. We've been using Stripe for our products and courses for a long time, and now with Tap to Pay on iPhone, you can take your business to the next level too. So visit stripe.com/tapiphone to learn more. Remember, folks, with Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, your business is always at your fingertips.
I appreciate the fact that you've acknowledged the fact that people have other responsibilities and needs, because I think that one of the narratives that we also have, you know, that is counter to the whole starving artist thing is that, oh, you can go and you can do anything, you can be anything, but that doesn't really take reality into account as far as I'm concerned. And I want to come back to this, but before we do that, you know, before we do that, one thing I wonder is, how old were you when this interest in comics was sparked, and what was it that sparked the interest?
Oh man, comics for me is the closest thing I have to a religious calling. I found them. I really do, man. I think of myself as some sort of, you know, this sounds cheesy, but some sort of fucking like warrior monk, like dedicated to furthering the ideals of an ancient cause. Comics, whether you want to admit it or not, have been around almost the beginning of mankind. You know, the caves of Lascaux are comics. The Sistine Chapel literally has sequential panels showing narrative change over time. They don't have word balloons, but it's literally a fucking comic on the walls, not on the ceiling. The ceiling is just a giant tableau, but like, you look at the walls and it's just, you know, it's biblical stories told through image and sustaining images over time, which is what a comic is. And I found them when I was really young, probably 4 or 5. I was really obsessed with the Hardy Boys and Nancy Drew and Boxcar Children, kind of boy and girl adventurer detective style stories. And we were at the library and they had a large collection of Hergé's Tintin comics, the bande dessinée about a, you know, young boy reporter and his talking dog. And I lost my mind. I was just like, oh yeah. Oh no. Yeah. This is what it is. This is what I should do. And I've basically been making comics since, you know, like I self-published comics. When I was a little kid, I drew comics and, sketchbooks all the time. I think I was visiting my parents recently and I was trying to find it, but I couldn't find it. I think I won like a writing award, like a county fair writing award for this weird little illustrated book that I made where it was called like Batman's First Ride. I think I was like 7, 8. And I wrote a story about Batman buying the Batmobile and I illustrated it. So I like, it was like a weird illustrated novel where it was like, I don't know, 5 pages of 10 pages, whatever, of me like writing about Bruce Wayne going to a like car lot and buying the Batmobile. And I won some sort of award for it. Like I remember going to the county fair, which is the most Arizona thing I could have said, but I remember going to a county fair and there being like a big glass case with a bunch of pieces of paper, like stories kids had written on it. And then in one of the cases, my Batman, you know, Batman's Batmobile or whatever the fuck it was called story. And there was a big blue ribbon on it. And I was looking through a bunch of, you know, boxes at my parents' house a couple months ago, trying to find that. And it's either lost to time or DC Comics has finally come for me.
Well, you discovered this at such a young age. And I feel like I've had two types of guests here. Those who, you know, have this sort of insight at a young age and they follow it, you know, to their grave. And they just know this is it. This is what I was destined to do. And then the alternative are those people who had that moment like you did when they were younger, but completely ignored it. Why do you think people do the latter?
Kind of back to what we were talking about before, because society says, you know, you should have a white picket fence and a house and 2.5 kids and a mortgage. And it's hard to envision those things when you're in a creative space. You know, you're like, especially in an industry like comics where there's not a lot of money. And it's hard to break in because there's 7 people. It's understandable. I get why certain people would be politely discouraging of their young of like, hey, maybe you know, you could like have that as a hobby, but like what about a career where there's like an upside that's almost guaranteed of like if you go to med school you're gonna make a lot of money. I mean, it's unfortunate. but it's understandable. And I don't know. I think there's something fascinating about it, though, on both ends. I think it's interesting on a character level, learning about people who buck that system and decide they don't want to do it. And I think it's interesting because those systems are not as easy as they're presented to us. Like saying that, you can just like go to school and then get a high paying job is also something of a fallacy, especially now. Like it's very difficult to graduate from prestigious programs. It's very difficult to make connections in any industry. Like, I don't know when the last time you had to apply for jobs were, but it fucking sucks, bro. Like, it's not fun.
So one thing that I, am just morbidly curious about is I feel like comics have this almost cult-like culture around them. It's kind of like, when you meet another comic book person, you have this sort of mutual recognition of, oh, you're a weirdo like me. I love you. And why is that? Like, what is it about comics that create the kind of culture where you have something like Comic-Con that emerges from it?
Yeah, this is a topic that I love to talk about. The reason why comics are a weird third tier artistic medium in the United States is because of what was called the Kefauver hearings. Do you know this story?
No, I don't.
Oh, so, okay. So this is fascinating. Good. Oh, perfect. I just wanted to make. I didn't know how detail I should make this or not. But yeah, this is a fascinating story. So basically, our cultural memory has erased the fact that comic books in the 1930s and 1940s were the dominant form of media, period, full stop. Radio was nowhere near the cultural penetration and cultural ubiquity of comic books. Comic books were selling millions of copies a week. They were selling so much that comic book publishers didn't actually calibrate print runs to a prospective audience. They just would, the standard run for a book was basically a million copies, and they would know how much a book sold because they would get it back. They were like returns. They would get the returns back and be like, oh, okay, so we got 50,000 copies back. So we sold 950,000. We should probably print a little more next time. And then they would, mulch those books and print more, which is a crazy way to do business. It's a crazy way to do business. And so it was so ubiquitous that, somewhat similar to how video games or rap music or any of the cultural boogeymen that we trot out every 10 years, comic books got blamed for society's ills. There was a psychiatrist named Frederick Wortham, who was kind of a luminary of kind of one of the first cultural critics. He was like one of the first people to be like, I don't know if TV is healthy for people to just sit there and watch for hours on end. And one of his first kind of causes that he took up to kind of crusade against was that comics were the primary driving inspiration behind juvenile delinquency. So in about 1954-ish, he wrote a book called Seduction of the Innocent, where he had worked at a mental health clinic in Harlem called the Lafargue Clinic. And he was interviewing all of these, wayward youths, people who had committed horrible crimes to people who had done shoplifting. It spanned the gamut, right? The only consistent factor is that this specific mental health clinic was founded by black luminaries and Frederick Wortham, who is a white German man, if you couldn't tell from his name. And so it was the first free mental health clinic in the United States aimed at African-American individuals. So all of the kids he was talking to were black. And all of these kids who had gotten in trouble with the law or whatever, he interviewed them, and they all said that the kind of inspiration or the thing they consumed or the thing they enjoyed the most was comics. And so he took that and extrapolated it into, I think comics are permanently ruining children's kind of mental acuity. I think that they're dumbing children down, and I think that they're instilling in them a sense of violence and an urge to commit crimes, because at that point in time in the mid-1950s, crime comics were really, really popular. So what he did is he wrote this book. Well, he first wrote an article for Life magazine, I think. I think it was Life magazine, called The Comics Not Funny. And were the comics very funny? There's two articles, one written by the guy who created Wonder Woman, William Moulton Marston, and one written by Wortham. And they're like a duology where Frederick Wortham wrote, Frederick Wortham wrote the comics very funny, and William Moulton Marston wrote the comics not funny. And they kind of were having this public discourse, a tete-a-tete about, you know, are comics ruining the youth? And he wrote a book about it called Seduction of the Innocent, which caused a massive cultural dialogue that basically spawned mass comic book burnings. Comics were outlawed in like 7 states in the U.S. And a senator named Estes Kefauver, who was a Southern senator, was prepping a presidential run. And so he used this as his kind of like cause du jour. And so he organized a public congressional hearing to attempt to ascertain if comics were actually having effect on the youth of the nation and whether they should be curbed or censored or regulated, much like happened in the 90s with video games when the MPAA put, or not MPAA, what's it called? The MPAA? The ratings board.
I know what you're talking about. I don't know the exact name, but I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, the teen, mature, everyone, those ratings systems that came out of the Joseph Lieberman kind of witch hunt video game trials. The same thing happened in 54 with the Kefauver hearings, where they wanted a regulation, they wanted a censorship board, which ultimately is what happened. The all of the comic book publishers got together, and they threw one of the publishers, the one that was being blamed for the most egregious or extreme content, this publisher named Bill Gaines, who ran Entertaining Comics, aka EC Comics. They produced crime suspense stories, Tales from the Crypt, Weird Science, very, very iconic and kind of like medium pushing work. And they all threw him under the bus, and they were like, fuck that guy. We're going to start the Comics Code Authority, which was a censorship organization that basically made all of the comics really shitty for like 40 years and literally outlawed genres. Like, you couldn't have a vampire in a comic. You couldn't have a werewolf in a comic. You couldn't have the bad guys win. You couldn't show drug use. You couldn't show men and women kissing in any sort of sense other than romantic. So because of that, the fallout of A, the censorship board, and B, the mass comic book burnings and outlawing of comics, they now have this reputation as being either for little kids, which has now kind of started to dissipate due to the success of the Marvel movies and superhero movies in general. But specifically, the reason why it's a secret handshake is because it used to be the most popular medium in the country, and then overnight was basically cordoned off into non-existent backroom alley bullshit. And so now that censorship era stifled the growth of the medium. You know, the only thing you could do after the Kefauver hearings was basically make superhero comics, because they were the only thing that weren't directly outlawed. And it's a horrible and depressing state of affairs, because comics in America and comics in Japan were basically on a neck and neck trajectory for most of the 50s. And then we had the Kefauver hearings and they didn't. And look at what manga is. It's like a, you know, $16 billion industry a year. They have, you know, stories told in every genre, in every style imaginable, aimed at children, teens, preteens, adults, men, women, grandpas, grandmas, shopping manga, cooking manga, you name it, and it exists there. Over here, there are a lot of interesting things happening. I'm not saying that there aren't, but it is definitely more of a cult or fringe thing as opposed to mainstream culture.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I do want to talk about the process of what goes into creating a comic and you know, go back to talking about, you know, the careers of creatives. But what's been the trajectory, you know, after your parents encouraged you? You know, obviously, I know this from having talked to enough creatives that there's no way this was a straight and, you know, narrow path.
Yeah. I went to school for illustration. And then I got out of school, had a bunch of weirdo jobs. Decided that drawing the style of comics that I draw are pretty unique and not, as commercial. But I have interests in a lot of different stuff. And the way that could help leverage paying bills is to write stuff for other people. So, I still draw comics. I, you know, work on them every day. But I think over the last, you know, however many years, I've developed a little bit of a career as a writer of comics or basically anything else. I've written infomercials. I wrote a feature film that's on Netflix right now. I wrote for, Cartoon Network's Ben 10 reboot series. I literally worked for a paint company writing about paint. Like if you ever want a really difficult creative challenge, try to find an interesting way to get 600 words out of, you know, Tahoe yellow. You just be like, all right, this will make a great accent wall to your new house, blah, 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 blah. So yeah, I kind of bounced around doing various writing jobs and making comics and writing comics. And then when I moved to Los Angeles, basically I was living in San Diego writing for that paint company. And I was like, this fucking sucks, bro. Like, I want to write and I want to draw. I want to make stuff, tell stories, but I really don't want to work at this fucking paint company anymore. And I came home one day and I lived in a pretty rough area. And unfortunately, there was a woman who I'm assuming was a drug addict, because I don't think the human body moves this way if you're not on something. And she was overdosing on my front steps. And it was just like a wake up call. I you know, went inside, I called the ambulance, they came out, they got her, they helped her, I hope. She was like frothing at the mouth and twitching in the street. And I was just like, this is intense. And life is short. What do I want to do? I want to write, and I want to not be in San Diego anymore. I'm going to move to LA, try and break into movie stuff and make comics. And I had just gotten back from the comic book store, and Casanova Volume 3, Issue 4 had just come out. Casanova's my favorite comic of all time. It's a spy comic about a guy who travels in between dimensions. And I opened it up, I read it, and the last page is Casanova Quinn, the main character, standing in front of the Hollywood sign. And I was like, fuck, man, I don't really believe in extra, you know, signs. I don't really believe in like religious symbolism or like, but fuck, man, this is like the universe telling me I got to go to LA. I got to do this. All right, I'm going to do it. And then I start reading the letters column, which was on the back of that page. And the first letter is from me that I had written in like 2 years prior. And I was like, all right, I got to do it. And like 2 weeks later, I was working in LA, writing commercials for a company and starting work on the webcomic Action Hospital, which is how I met basically all of my LA friends and my longtime creative partner, Nicole Gu. Because I would just go, basically I got to LA and I was like, all right, I got to attack this like it's a full-time job, even if it's not. So whenever I wasn't working for the commercial company writing commercials, I would go to artist meetups, I would go to comic book meetups, I would go to film networking events and just try and meet people. Because, you know, I don't come from anybody who's connected, you know, like my, this, you know, local theater in Tucson, Arizona ain't getting you a career directing the moving pictures, you know what I mean? And so I just would go to, networking events, or I would go to sketchbook sessions or plein air sessions, or there used to be a really cool drink and draw in downtown Los Angeles that doesn't really exist anymore. I mean, it does, but it's not really the same. I would just meet people and I'd be like, hey, I'm working on this webcomic. Do you want to draw 8-page stories? Because that's what it is. I write them all and there's going to be 8-page stories. I can't pay you, but it'll be a fun experience and we'll get to make things and there'll be an end product that you can have as a portfolio piece. And I met a bunch of people that way. And that's kind of what started the journey. That was a little bit of a rambling explanation, but
no, that was perfect. So, you know, we were talking about the fact that, you know, this is a life in which nothing is guaranteed and anything is possible. How it's possible you'll be poor for, you know, immense amounts of time. It's possible you'll die poor if you choose to, you know, go down this path. And I think that what intrigues me is, you know, there's an article on the Harvard Business Review that this venture capitalist wrote titled "The Creator Economy Has No Middle Class," which I think is really true, right? Because if you look at, you know, sort of the creator economy on the internet, it's a microcosm of the actual economy. I think we have what I call digital inequality, where a handful of people get the majority of the traffic on the web, a handful of people get the majority of funds on, you know, crowdfunding platforms like Patreon. So in the midst of all that, how does somebody navigate the sort of landscape of the creator economy, you know, while knowing that is all there? Because that's real. You can't ignore that.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And the way I navigate it is, don't worry about it. What am I going to do? Like, stress out that I don't have a billion followers? Like, I don't know. Like, I just make stuff. I try and make work that I think is good. I try and, I did a Kickstarter last year that made like 22 grand or whatever, which to me, that's a lot of money, in the grand scheme of, you know, this conversation of the creator economy and, this idea of digital inequality. Yeah, that's still, you know, bargain basement, nothing, but that's not how I measure success. I measure success as being able to produce my ideas. I measure success as building a network of friends and fan base and a fan base one person at a time. I'm a big fan of this B movie actor, Robert Zadar. He was in movies like Maniac Cop, and Maniac Cop 2 and Maniac Cop 3. And if anybody hasn't seen Maniac Cop, please go. It's his magnum opus. But he also made a career being in a ton of other movies, like just hundreds and hundreds of these kind of B and C list level genre movies. And his whole shtick basically is he was an actor who had a disease or a disability where his, it's called cherubism, and his face, his chin, there was some sort of genetic anomaly where his body thought that his chin was calcium deficient. So over the course of his life, his chin and his face elongated. And he's also in Tango and Cash. If anybody's seen Tango and Cash, I think his character's name in Tango and Cash is literally The Face, which is odd because you would think it would be the chin, but whatever. So he took this objective disadvantage and turned it into a way of not only supporting himself, but making stuff that people connect with and relate to. And, that might not mean something to somebody else, but to me as a genre movie hound, that story is so uplifting and so cool. And did he have a tragic end where he died of cardiac arrest due to a life of habitual drug use? Probably largely spawned by this malady. Yeah. But he connected with a lot of people and made a lot of really great work. And my rubric for success is that if I kick the bucket with one person getting as much as I got out of Robert Zadar's body of work, I think that's a win, man. I think that's a win. You know, I mean, it's a little bit of a different conversation than you're having of how do we, you know, eat the digital rich, which I'm all for. Nom, 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 baby. But also, like, on an individual level, I can't control any of that. And I don't really concern myself with it. It's more just how can I make cool stuff and put one foot in front of the other? Because that's what a lot of being a creator online is, you know, those micro gains, unfortunately.
So just based on the way that you're talking about this, what I wonder is, did you grow up in an era that predated social media?
Yeah. Yes, I did. Which, you know, maybe that informs it, but I think that there's also just like, you kind of have to be a little bit of a nihilist and a little bit naive to try and do the things that I'm trying to do, you know? Like, if you looked at the numbers, you would get really dissuaded, you know? Like, so very few people are able to support themselves. You know, you just have to say, yeah, that's cool, but I don't give a shit. Like, I'm going to do this anyway, because what the fuck else is the other option, you know?
No, I completely agree. I was writing this piece about, you know, the hidden danger of metrics and how metrics, you know, are kind of a double-edged sword, because you can start to measure your worth as a creator according to metrics, and then that it can be incredibly demotivating.
Yeah.
Because you're just constantly, you know, comparing yourself to other people. Yeah. And
yeah, I think for me that I've experienced a kind of like being able to see the code of the matrix moment. And that kind of has informed my kind of distaste or lack of concern with that. Like, obviously, do I want to be able to have a massive following? Yes. Do I have a little following? Yeah. Would it be cooler if it was millions of people? Hell yeah, baby. But I experienced a defining moment for me in that in like 2013, 2012, when Instagram first introduced video, they selected me and like four or five other people who were doing time-lapse drawings to be the kind of discover page video comic book people. Basically, they kind of had all of these different verticals where they're like, all right, we're going to try and develop, you know, video for comics, video for comedy, video for this, video for that, whatever. And me, Jacqueline DeLeon, and like three or four other people all got picked because we just immediately started posting time lapses of us drawing. So the art or comics tag, if you were even remotely interested in that and you went on the explore page on Instagram, you would see one of our videos. And it was a really weird thing too, because it was just like, I just got like a push notification from Instagram that was like, you've been selected for this program. And I was like, what the fuck is this? This is so weird. And I posted a video of a time lapse of me working on a page from the book that I was drawing at that time. And it got like 4.5 million views in a day, 2 days. And it was, that's the most viral anything I've done has ever gone. And it was so interesting to see the funnel of like, all right, if it got 5 million views, it got 2,000 comments, it got 400 follows, and 20 of those followers are actual comic book people that engage with me on a regular basis. you know what I mean? And that funnel was just so eye-opening of like, oh, yeah. Okay, all right, this is bullshit. Like, I understand that, you know, I understand how the Instagram algorithm works and the TikTok algorithm works and all that stuff, but it's still just like, this is not like sustainable on a normal level, right? And you know, after that kind of experience, my profile rose. I got a lot more followers from it. You know, I had a couple other videos go pseudo viral basically because of that same program. And then Instagram was just like, yeah, we're good. We're not going to keep doing this anymore. And it was a big kind of eye-opening experience for me, where I kind of saw how the system worked firsthand. You know, it's one thing to be told those things. It's another thing to experience 4 million views. Yeah. And be like, oh, okay, all right, I see how this works. And you can't chase that dragon, or at least for me, like I can't chase that dragon. Like, does that mean that I'm not putting stuff online? Does that mean that I'm not trying to promote the work? Does that mean that I'm, you know, one of these people who's just like, oh, I'm just going to create in a vacuum and eventually someone will find it? Like, no, obviously not. But I just don't take it personal anymore. Like, if something is successful and gets views and stuff, cool. If it doesn't, whatever, moving on.
Yeah. I've heard a similar story from a friend of mine who told me about some Instagram model or somebody who wanted to start a t-shirt line, and she had investors lined up, and they said, and she had millions of followers, and they told her, if you can get people to buy 10 t-shirts, we will fund the company. And she couldn't even move 10 t-shirts with millions of followers.
You couldn't just call 10 friends and be like, fucking buy a shirt?
Yeah. But I mean, I think you bring up a good point, because you're highlighting sort of what I think is a misperception in culture about the value of a large social media following, particularly for creative people. And this is something I've always said, is that you can't hide shitty art behind great marketing. Eventually, yes, it'll be revealed for what it is.
Yes. Yeah, I completely agree. And I think also that, you know, there's an interesting tension between those two, right? I think it's kind of, it's a fascinating, deeply human experiment. I mean, and in some ways a negative way. Like, I don't think that it's positive that our deeply subjective human experience has been flattened into ones and zeros and is now turned into bikini pics and paid promotional posts. Like, I don't know that that's positive for anybody. But yet here we are, so let's fucking rock and roll, baby.
Yeah. So I have a question out of personal and morbid curiosity. What is the actual process for, you know, bringing a comic to life? Because, you know, one of the things I realized is we're going back to our interviews. My roommate and I were on a 17-hour drive back from Wisconsin. And we're like, you know, podcast transcripts suck. He said, well, what if you turned your transcripts into a comic book? And he's like, you can actually do that because you have the stories. And so I started storyboarding it. But now that I have you here, I'm trying to think of, okay, how do I know what to verbalize and what to illustrate? And, you know, Seth Godin always refers to this book, Understanding Comics by Scott McCloud. And he said, it's a, you know, all about what happens between the panels. So you know, what is this process? Like, how do you decipher what to keep in and what to leave out and really bring it to life and tell the story?
Yeah. I mean, for me, I'm obsessed with comics formalism. I'm somebody who loves the nuts and bolts of comics and how words and pictures interact in the human mind as a Hieronymus machine, synthesizing all of these data streams into a single cohesive vision. I love the medium. I love the weirdos who've pushed the medium forward. And I'm excited about the fact that there's still so much uncovered ground, you know, like both comics and film are basically mediums that have 100 years worth of history, which is crazy when you think about it. Paintings have been around for like 34,000 years, but comics and film, the two mediums that I care about most, are so young. And comics has been censored and truncated for the majority of its existence, which means that there's this grand vista of new things to be accomplished and explored. The pedantic response to your question is you write a script, which is usually delineated into panel by panel beats. Panel one, Joe walks into the door. Panel two, Joe sits down on the couch. Panel three, Joe cries himself to sleep on the couch. And then the next stage is either myself, because I do it all, or an artist will pencil the pages, they'll draw the various images, and then on a page, then it'll get inked, then it'll get scanned into the computer, then it'll be colored on the computer, then it'll get lettered, where the letterer and or me will create word balloons and drop in the text from the script into the word balloons, and then it'll get laid out in InDesign, and then the PDF will get sent to the printer, and then there'll be 2 months of haggling with a printer and being like, this isn't the right paper stock. And then the books will show up at your house and you'll be like, ah, yeah, this is great. Oh, but wait, there's this typo that I missed. But in terms of what you're talking about of like, what's the moment to select? That's the interesting part about comics, right? Like movies, you're watching time sustain, and you're watching continuous flow of time. In comics, you're watching time frozen. So you're watching almost kind of like if a movie is watching rain falling and you're watching in real time the droplets of water falling from the sky through the air and smacking into the ground, a comic is, as an author, you're picking what is the most interesting moment or what is the most me moment to pick in that scenario. Is your artistic sensibility that you like it when it just starts to rain, and so that you see the clouds that are just starting to unleash the water, but the water hasn't hit the ground, and the characters are looking up with the knowledge that water is coming? Is it characters being initially drenched? Is it characters having stood out in the rain for 5 minutes having this conversation while it's raining? That's the kind of interesting conundrum of the medium for me, is that it requires a very precise hand, and 9 times out of 10 it is produced by multiple people, which is really interesting because then you have to sustain a creative vision over multiple humans, which is way hard to do, especially when there's not a shitload of money like in movies where you can just pay people to not have their opinions and to take your opinions. In comics, 9 times out of 10 you're working with people that are just doing it to do it. So you kind of are like, hey, but what if it was just when the clouds open up? And they're like, nah, I think it's better if they're standing out in the rain for 15 minutes. Yeah, it's fascinating though. This is that toggling back and forth between which version of reality you live in is very interesting to me.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, one of the things that my roommates and I did, you know, in the middle of the pandemic, or what we thought was the middle of the pandemic, was we decided to go through, you know, all of the universe, the entire Marvel universe. And afterwards I got the Marvel Encyclopedia. And I think that what really struck me was just how complex it was, that one guy could just conceive this entire universe that was so interrelated and all the characters related somehow. And, you know, that turned into like this $1 billion empire. And it's funny.
By one guy, you mean Jack Kirby, right?
Is it Jack Kirby and Stan Lee, right? Or is it all Stan? Who is the guy who deserves the credit?
Well, one, I don't think there is one guy that deserves the credit. I think that's a fallacy that movie companies like to perpetuate because it makes it easy to point at kindly old Stan. But the reason Stan Lee has cameos in all those movies is because he won a lawsuit settlement in the early 2000s, not because he created all the characters. Like, he literally didn't create Captain America. He was 19. When Captain America was created by Joe Simon and Jack Kirby, he was their assistant. Create the Guardians. He didn't create the Guardians of the Galaxy. He didn't do any of that stuff. But then there's also this other conversation, which we don't necessarily have to get into just because it's a more kind of circuitous, longer conversation. But there's a discussion to be had of, did Stan create anything? Because I don't know if you're familiar, but the Marvel method, in air quotes, was the way that he designed things to work at Marvel. So Stan Lee was Martin Goodman, who was the owner of Timely, which later rebranded as Marvel Comics. He was his like nephew-in-law. He was an editor at the company and got so much kind of leeway due to his familial connections that he kind of figured out a way to take credit for a lot of stuff that he didn't do. The Marvel method is basically Stan would write a paragraph, give it to an artist, whether that be Stan Lee or Jack Kirby or Steve Ditko or John Romita Sr. or any of the stalwart kind of writer artists at the company. There were actual people who could write comics and actual people who could draw comics. And they would, based off of that beat sheet, that paragraph, they would create fully broken down, panel by panel, finished pages with temporary dialogue written in. And then Stan would come in and go over the top of that temporary dialogue and kind of massage it a little bit or change it or make it, you know, zhuzh it up or whatever. And, yeah, you know, there are some people who think that that is a very valuable and piece of the creative puzzle that is inextricable from the success of the Marvel Universe. And there are some people who think that that is the role of an editor. You know, obviously it's a very complex question. It's a very long discussion to have. But it's one that I like to bring up whenever somebody says, you know, well, there's one person created all that stuff. It's like, that should, like, Marvel Comics has been publishing for 80 years. And like, yeah, Stan and Jack created, in air quotes, created the X-Men. But like, let's be real. Chris Claremont is the person who made the X-Men what they are, you know, and every character, every franchise has something like that. Like, yes, Wally Wood and Stan Lee co-created Daredevil, but Daredevil wouldn't be Daredevil without Frank Miller. You know what I mean? And like, there's all of these case in points of like, everyone wants the simple solution. Everyone wants, this is the person to point to, where unfortunately, life is a lot messier than that and a lot more complex, especially when it involves a medium that is not particularly respected, where there's not a lot of documents to purport what actually happened and clean up some of these weird gray areas. Because sometimes characters would come from, you know, a car ride. Like, there's, you know, the urban legend is that Silver Surfer got birthed from a car ride from Long Island, where Stan and Jack were driving into the Manhattan office after picking up John Romita Sr. And they were having a conversation about, like, we need some sort of person to like set up Galactus as this big bad. Like, what are we going to do? I'm like, well, what if there's like a, he's got like a herald that like flies in front of him and like warns people that he's going to come, and like, oh, all right. Yeah. But what would he be? I don't know. Kids like surfing these days. What if he was a like surfed the sky, which is the most Jack Kirby idea. And I love it. Naked silver guy on a surfboard. Only Jack Kirby could make that work.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. I mean, even in just having this conversation with you, you know, so, you know, when we're Indian kids are, you know, well-versed in Hindu mythology, you know, the Mahabharata and Ramayana. The funny thing is that, you know, we learned all of that from reading comic books when we were kids.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I have some of those. I bought a bunch of I've never actually.
They're really good.
Them. Yeah. They look really cool.
And they're really easy ways to understand things that, you know, seem incredibly complex, but are not. But I remember thinking, looking at this, and was like, why couldn't somebody create a Marvel universe from this, like a modern day retelling of this entire story and turn these people into modern day superheroes? Like, that was one of the ideas I had. I was like, that's a potential $1 billion franchise in the making, just in case you wanted to dive back into it.
I mean, it's not exactly what you're talking about, but there was in like 2007 or 2006, there were Virgin Comics tried to do something along those lines where they had like a line of, they had like two lines. This is my memory of it. They had like a line that was basically comics based off of ideas from famous movie directors. And then they had a line of comics that was based off of Hindu mythology. I think this is all so dimly recollected though. It would be cool. I'd read them.
Wow. Wow. Well, this has been really, really fascinating. So I have one final question for you, which is how we finish all of our interviews at The Unmistakable Creative. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
I would say that something is unmistakable when it is undeniably personal. I think that's the key to a lot of successful artwork. And also going back to our conversation about kind of digital work ecosystems, a lot of why things don't work, you know, because sometimes the world shies away from the deeply personal in commercial settings. I think in an artistic setting, the more personal it is, the more universal it is, and the more artistically successful it can be. In a commercial setting, I think those scales sometimes tend to be flopped, which is why you get bland blockbusters that have, you know, the same story beats in every, you know, it's a father and son story. It's a redemption story, you know. But yeah, I think something is unmistakable when you feel the authorial hand behind it, when you can feel that someone, even if you don't know what the personal metaphor is, but you can feel there's a personal metaphor behind it. That's what I look for anyway. And what I think is interesting work is when you can tell someone is writing a story for you and for them, and sometimes of the same story, and sometimes they're not. I think that's really an interesting and beautiful thing.
Wow. Amazing. Well, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to join us and share your story and your wisdom and insights with our listeners. Where can people find out more about you, your work, and everything they're up to?
Yeah. My book, Everyone is Tulip, is out right now from Dark Horse. It's about a young girl who moves to Los Angeles to become an actor and then gets sucked up into the high stakes world of YouTube performance art, which is a real thing. Drawn by Nicole Gu, colored by Ellie Hall, written by yours truly, available wherever books are sold. I also have a Star Trek book that came out last week, Star Trek Voyager Seven's Reckoning, illustrated by Angel Hernandez, colors by Rhonda Patterson. You can find me online at heydavebaker.com. Or if you want to listen to my podcast, which is a deep dive explainer podcast about weird or obscure topics, you can find that by searching Deep Cuts or deepcutspod.com.
Awesome. And for everybody listening, we will wrap the show with that.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Unmistakable Creative Podcast. While you were listening, were there any moments you found fascinating, inspiring, instructive, maybe even heartwarming? Can you think of anyone, a friend or a family member, who would appreciate this moment? If so, take a second and share today's episode with that one person, because good ideas and messages are meant to be shared.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Have you ever felt a twinge of worry about AI taking over your job or diluting your creativity? Well, what if you could turn that fear into creative fuel? We've just published an amazing new ebook called The 4 Keys to Success in an AI World, and this is more than just a guide. It's a deep exploration into the human skills that AI can't touch, the skills that are essential for standing out and thriving no matter how much technology evolves. We're talking about real differentiators here like creativity, emotional intelligence, critical thinking, and much more. Inside, you'll find actionable insights and strategies to develop these skills, whether you're a creative person, a business person, or just simply someone who loves personal development. This isn't a story about tech taking over. It's a story of human creativity thriving alongside AI. Picture this: AI as your creative co-pilot, not just as a tool, but a collaborator that enhances your unique human skills. The 4 Keys ebook will show you exactly how to do that and view AI in a new way that empowers you instead of overshadows you. Transform your creative potential today. Head over to unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. Use the number 4, K-E-Y-S. That's unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. And download your free copy.